Please rise. Court is now in session. Please be seated.
Morning, counsel. Ready to proceed?
Yes.
Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, good morning. I'm Joseph Bernstein. I'm here representing Akbar Hassan L. There are three issues that we raised in a brief. I'm only going to limit the oral argument to two of those three issues. The two issues I'd like to talk about first is the felony murder conviction and whether or not that conviction should stand based on the lack of evidence that the killing was in furtherance of the attempted murder felony. And at trial, the defense moved for acquittal as to the felony murder charge. That was denied, and the argument's being renewed here. And I think probably to understand our argument, you have to understand, and there's a citation in the brief to the commentary to the Delaware Criminal Code when the code was first enacted. There was felony murder. The initial proposition was that it was reckless, had to be a reckless killing, and both the language of, in the course of, and in furtherance of, was in the first proposal. At some point, the reckless requirement was dropped, and then at the very end, it was put back in. And the point that the commentators made was that a reckless killing is logically inconsistent with something that moves the felony along. In other words, if you don't, a killing may be foreseeable in the sense that if you bring a weapon to a crime, it's foreseeable that something bad might happen. However, in the absence of some evidence that the killing was planned or really even anticipated, it's illogical to say that a reckless state of mind is going to can accompany the in furtherance of requirement. They're just logically incompatible, and that's what the commentators to the Delaware Criminal Code noted.
And help me understand this situation. Two people decide to commit a robbery, and one of them, and after they say, let's go rob the ice cream truck, this is a hypothetical. One of them pulls out a gun, and the other person says, well, what are you going to do with a gun? And the answer is, I'm going to use it if I have to. Then the robbery proceeds, and someone gets shot. You seem to suggest that taking a gun on a robbery might result in someone getting shot, but if you didn't contemplate that when you set off, then you can't be convicted of felony murder, when it seems equally logical to assume that someone who goes armed to commit a robbery would intend to use it if they have to.
Well, I think the answer to that is there really wasn't any evidence in this case that there was a plan to kill or talk about using weapons. To be sure, they carried weapons.
Both of them
had weapons. Robbery. There were two weapons, and there were two shots fired. And I would suggest that the strongest evidence in the record that the killing itself was both unanticipated and unplanned was what happened when the shots went off.
Well, I know you made the argument that after the person was shot, everyone ran away, and clearly if they intended to shoot the person in furtherance of the robbery, once the victim was disabled, they would have proceeded with the robbery. But that seems to assume that there was a completely innocent explanation for two people taking the guns on the robbery and firing the shots, and that no one ever contemplated anyone would get killed.
Well, I guess I'm going to go back, I guess, to the Delaware Code commentary, and that's essentially, they say just the opposite. They say that it's just simple, I think the quote is, purest retribution, simply because a defendant is unlucky enough to kill someone accidentally or negligently while he is committing or fleeing from the scene of a felony. The actor selected by the present law for more severe punishment may not have expected death, nor could he have expected it.
But that's where, help us understand the facts of accident. I could see the commentary applying to a situation where people rob a bank, and during the course of driving the getaway car, you run over a pedestrian. That would seem to be something that no one ever contemplated.
Well, I think this court, and I think it's the Hall case, has defined the term accident to include reckless conduct. So there are certain accidents that are just pure accidents, no question about that, where a chain of events occurs that no one could have foreseen. There's another kind of accident, if you will, that's reckless conduct. Waving a gun around in a crowded room, the gun might go off and kill somebody. Now, you don't anticipate that that's going to happen. You don't intend that that's going to happen, but it can happen. And the term recklessly is used in the criminal code encompasses accidental killings where if you thought about the conduct, you probably wouldn't have done it, or you didn't think about the consequences. So I think there certainly is a logical anomaly between the recklessness of an act and the in furtherance of requirement.
Well, in this case, where one person was kind of boosting another person into the ice cream truck and the guns fired, I understand your argument to be it discharged accidentally. But then we have both guns being discharged. So are we to infer that one person accidentally discharged their gun and that caused the other person to also accidentally discharge their weapon?
I don't think anyone will ever know, but I think one thing is important, at least with Mr. Hassan L. Mr. Hassan L. was found not guilty of intentional murder by this jury. And that suggests that the jury believed that the killing was not intentional and that it was reckless conduct rather than intentional conduct. So the verdict in this case, I suggest, bears out the argument that there is a logical disconnect between reckless conduct and the in furtherance of requirement. How can you possibly, in furtherance of requirement, suggest some planning, intention, some state of mind other than reckless conduct?
Well, is it possible to construe it that since there are more than one way to commit a robbery, you can strong arm rob someone without a weapon, but if you are reckless enough to choose to take a weapon to the robbery and you believe that the weapon will be intimidating and assist you in furtherance of the robbery, so you carry it on your person and you have it in an operative position while you're committing the robbery, even if it goes off accidentally, doesn't common sense suggest that you recklessly brought the weapon, held the weapon in a position where it could be discharged recklessly, and you had it there for the purpose of furthering the success of the robbery?
Well, you have to act recklessly with respect to the killing, at least recklessly. But the killing itself has to be in furtherance of the robbery as a matter of fact.
You're saying that any time the robbery isn't carried out, you couldn't be convicted of felony murder. Let's suppose that the person said, okay, the ice cream man is wounded, let's get the money. So we know their intention is to do it, but then they're interrupted and they run away. You seem to be suggesting that if they never completed taking the money, even though that was their announced intent, they
couldn't be convicted. The way the state indicted the felony murder was they didn't indict it felony murder robbery. They indicted it felony murder attempted robbery. I think the state's kind of stuck with that. I'd like to move on to the other issue. I have only have, let's see, 10 minutes left. The other issue I want to talk about is the Robert Zayas statement and the admissibility of that statement under 3507. And here again, the objection at trial was not to what Robert Zayas was saying in the statement, but what the police were saying about what Robert Zayas was saying. And if you look at the excerpts from the interview that are in the brief, there couldn't be a more blatant, at least in my opinion, a more blatant example of police vouching for or giving what the court has characterized, I think it was Huggins, an interpretive narrative, kind of a gloss on what Robert Zayas was saying. Now, the trial court's rationale was, well, it's an interrogation, so it should come in under 3507. And my response to that is, the police are perfectly free to conduct interrogations any way they want to. If they want to conduct interrogations with kind of the carrot and stick approach that was used here, that's fine. But when it comes to a trial and when it comes to what the jury should hear about what a witness says, it's not okay. It's not okay to use 3507 to basically allow the jury to hear not just what the witness says, but the police officers, in effect, vouching, you know, now you're telling the truth, now you're not. It's almost like if you have a witness on the stand, somebody standing next to him, and every
time... Well, I asked Mr. Donovan about this, but what's your understanding of what the state was trying to get in Zayas's statement that he hadn't already said, you know, on the witness stand?
I don't know.
Because normally you'd be looking for some type of contradiction. And in reading this video, there doesn't appear to be anything that was contradictory.
There was not. I mean, Robert Zayas testified in person at trial, and his testimony was consistent with, I would say, what the police believed to be the truth, whatever that was. Why the state decided, well, we really need to put this statement in, my personal opinion is, was overkill. And I think the only purpose it was served was they wanted the jury to hear this running commentary by the police.
Well, that's one inference. I guess the other would be to demonstrate that the live testimony is likely to be credible because, after all, he said it closer to the event than someone else, and he said it twice.
Well, they could have done that and redacted the police commentary. That's what we wanted.
I understand that. Would you explain why the curative instruction that the trial judge gave doesn't solve the problem?
Well, yes. I can do that. Typically, curative instructions or limiting instructions, they're typically come about where the court's trying to kind of put the toothpaste back in the tube. Something's happened in the trial, it shouldn't have happened, and the trial judge is trying to ameliorate that. The cat's already out of the bag. Here, the cat wasn't out of the bag yet. The trial judge says, I'm going to let this stuff in. And basically, the defense is left with the Hobson's choice. What do you do? You let it all in without a limiting instruction, or do you ask for limiting instruction? Whatever you do, you're dead in the water. So this is not a case where a limiting instruction is used, what I would say, for a proper purpose of trying to put the cat back in the bag or the toothpaste back in the tube. This was simply a device that was calculated, I would suggest, to try and ameliorate what was a very questionable ruling on the admissibility of the statement. I think the trial court wanted to have it both ways, and the defense was left with a choice, well, what are we going to do? Are we going to let it in and have let the jury think what they might, or let it in with the instruction to the jury, in effect, you know, ignore the 500-pound elephant in the room, which I would suggest, given the repetitiveness and the emphasis in this interrogation, the curative, this is a case where curative instruction or limiting instruction really didn't limit anything. It wasn't something that was done to try and cure some mistake that had come in inadvertently in the trial. And I don't think the court, I don't believe the court should extend the protection of limiting instructions to this type of situation. This was just plain and simple vouching, plain and simple interpretive narrative. There was no reason for the jury to hear this. The state's argument that there was no prejudice because the jury may not have believed Zayas, and I would suggest the answer to that is it's also possible the jury focused on what the police were saying and not what Zayas was saying, because they'd already heard Zayas. What they hadn't heard was the police saying, okay, yeah, we don't believe you, we know what happened, you're lying. And when he says something that favors their theory of the case, now you're on the right track, pat him on the back, shake his hand. The jury should not have been exposed to that sort of performance. There was a way to get that statement in. The statement could have come in perfectly clean without the commentary. And the commentary, it was improper. Jury never should have heard it. I would suggest it couldn't be cured by curative instruction. Unless the court has any other questions, I'm going to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, you have 3 minutes. Thank you, Mr.
Okay, thank you.
Please, the court. As to the felony murder charge, I think if Mr. Bernstein's view of felony murder is taken to its logical conclusion, I would fairly eviscerate the felony murder statute. The way the state sees it is that if one, as the defendants did in this case, decide to commit a robbery and arm themselves with operable weapons, load those operable weapons, and in the course of the robbery, point those operable weapons at the victim, they have basically put in place all the elements of felony murder, including the reckless mens rea. All that is necessary is for one of those guns to go off at this point and kill the intended victim, which is what happened in this case. Now, Mr. Guy and Mr. Hassan L. could have armed themselves with starter pistols. They could have armed themselves with model weapons that looked real. They could have taken real weapons and made sure they were unloaded if their only intent was to intimidate Mr. Alamiri, the ice cream truck vendor. But they made sure
it seems that perhaps that's correct under the current statute, but the statute that talks about in furtherance of, the statute that applies to this particular case, at least as I understand the argument, the state has charged in such a fashion that it has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the murder itself was in furtherance of the robbery. And in a case where the murder occurred accidentally, even if it was reckless to bring the guns there and the foreseeable consequence might have been that someone could be killed, either one of them or the robbery victim, isn't enough that the murder itself has to move along the progress of the robbery to culmination. And that's not what the facts support here, is what I think I heard in the argument. Now, I may have it wrong, but I think that's what I heard.
Well,
how does the death here commit to the furtherance of the culmination of the robbery?
Yes, and I think it's the in furtherance of is more than the final actual discharge and killing of the victim. It's the actions of the defendant here in arming themselves with operable weapons and pointing those operable weapons of the victim at the victim, which then naturally leads to the victim's death for whatever reason. And we cannot crawl inside the heads of Mr. Guy and Mr. Al-Omari or Mr. Hassan L. and decide why they all of a sudden decided to pull the triggers. One may have been, as Mr. Bernstein suggested, one may have been simply a nervous tick, and the other one said, oh, one person shot, I guess I ought to shoot too.
Well, the indictment in this case was for attempted robbery, is that correct?
Yes, but well, that's what it turned out to be.
Right. And so that, and that's attempted robbery is a felony.
Yes.
And so what the state would have to prove is that the shots occurred in furtherance of the attempted robbery.
In furtherance of their attempt to commit robbery, yes. Now, of course, the both defendants in planning the robbery didn't plan to commit attempted robbery. They planned to commit robbery. They planned to get away with the money. They apparently panicked when the guns went off and they saw Mr. Al-Omari fall to the ground and they ran off. Certainly their conduct with regard to the homicide that eventually occurred was reckless, and indeed, as the jury found in convicting Mr. Hassan L. of second-degree murder, it was recklessness coupled with a cruel, wicked, and indifference to human life. And so that is the jury speaking. That's they saw the, for whatever reason, the gun went off, the guns went off. The jury found that their actions to this point, to the point of the discharge of the weapons, constituted the mens rea for second-degree murder, which was more than they needed. I think it was indicted recklessness under the felony murder. So it was more than reckless, as the jury decided. They decided it was not intentional. But certainly their actions did, the actions leading to the death of Mr. Al-Omari constituted the mens rea, the state of mind requirement necessary for conviction of felony murder, as the felony murder statute is promulgated here in Delaware. And there is, of course, a separate mens rea requirement for the felony murder in addition to the mens rea requirement for the underlying felony here, robbery. At trial, and the defendants cited to this court's decision in Williams v. State, which dealt with the in furtherance, and I think the trial judge's rationale in rejecting Williams as precedent under the facts of this case is worth repeating, that in Williams, the underlying felony, the felony that was intended right from the outset was the murder and not the burglary. The burglary was committed in furtherance of the murder and not vice versa, as was the case here. This is basically an all too frequent occurrence. Murders, homicides committed in the course of and in furtherance of robberies and drug deals. There's nothing particularly unusual about this case.
Let's move to the 3507 statement.
Yes.
If 3507 permits the introduction of a prior statement from the witness, then why is it proper in this case to give the preamble? I know that sometimes you want to give the question and the answer for context, but in this particular case, you see a lot of preamble where the witness is recalcitrant and he's being encouraged, cajoled by the police. But if we really want to know what the witness's statement is that would be evidence against these defendants, it would be a fairly brief excerpt. And I ask that in the context that probably most citizens do not know the police are allowed to lie to people during interrogation. It's permissible to trick people during interrogation. So to have a curative instruction later that says you should really disregard the police side of the interview because that's just normal police work, focus on what the defendant said. Why was it relevant to have all of this extraneous material under the guise of calling it a 3507 statement?
Well, I think a number of the reason the statement was relevant for a number of reasons.
The statement, the extraneous information that wasn't a statement.
Right. In its entirety, including what the police, how the police got the, basically extracted over the course of the interrogation, piece by piece, the evidence from a obviously very recalcitrant individual. Mr. Zayas did not come to the police as a cooperative witness. In fact, he was anything but. And I think what I think is most significant, and what I think the jury should know, was that at the time Mr. Zayas was interrogated by the two officers, he was a suspect. What the police knew to that point was there's this Zayas fellow who flags down the ice cream man, and then Mr. Guy and Mr. Hassan El come up and with guns and shoot. So Mr. Zayas certainly looks like a full-fledged accomplice here. Now, as it turns out, believing Mr. Zayas, and what he says has some support from other evidence, is that, well, he did know that, or at least strongly suspected that Mr. Guy and Mr. Hassan El were going to commit a robbery, although he really didn't think that, but he was going to flag down the ice cream man anyhow because he had got a frozen soda, and they found the frozen soda, the police found the frozen soda, so that part pans out. So his involvement in this was not quite as intimate as it at first seemed. So Mr. Zayas at this point is a suspect. And now, I think during the course
the motion at trial was for redaction. And the motion is, why don't we take out the part where the police say they know everything? And why don't we take out the part where the police say Zayas is a liar? Why don't we just put in the substantive part that's relevant to something at issue in this case? Why shouldn't there have been a redaction?
Well, I suppose two answers. The first is that the defendant Zayas is not being gored here. Mr. Zayas is the state's witness. And if the police are browbeating him and calling him a liar, there's no way that that is going to impact negatively on the defendant's case. Distinguishes this case from, say, most recently, this court's decision in Miller, which this court held that certain statement which the defendant was being interrogated, and this court held, although it was harmless error, nevertheless, the court should have redacted certain statements that the police officer made suggesting that the defendant used drugs or was intoxicated. In this case, the state's witness is being shown to be a recalcitrant witness. And I think more importantly, this goes to rebut any inference that the jury might make that Mr. Zayas's testimony at trial was recent fabrication on his part or was at least embroidered as a result of some kind of sweetheart deal. I think he ended up pleading guilty to a conspiracy. So as a result of the sweetheart deal he had made with the state, he's going to, you know, sing the state song here and going to embroider his trial testimony. So I think it's important for the jury to understand that, Mr. Zayas is a reluctant witness, that the statement he made at the time he was a suspect is in large measure, in essence, consistent with his trial testimony. And again, 3507, unlike the rules of evidence, do allow in prior consistent statements. So I don't see prejudice to the defendant resulting from this. And the third thing is, reading through this statement, I'm not quite sure. The police officers extracting the statement and the statement itself are so intertwined. It's not like in the Miller case where there were a few statements that the police officer made. Oh, maybe you were drinking, maybe you were taking drugs, which could be easily redacted. In this case, what you would end up with is some sort of incredibly bowdlerized version of the statement, which just shows Mr. Zayas coming in and saying all these wonderful things and telling the police, you know, exactly what happened, as if he were a cooperative witness right from the beginning. So I think, were I certainly defense counsel, I think I would want the jury to know that Mr. Zayas, this was like pulling teeth, and maybe Mr. Zayas, I mean, I could, as defense counsel, make hay with this and say, oh, well, he said this just to save his hide. He thought he was going to be charged, so he just pointed the finger of suspicion at somebody else. But in any event, I think both sides could make, as the trial judge realized, I mean, both sides could take something positive and something negative away from letting the whole statement in. So I think the trial judge, plus the trial judge's very thorough limiting instruction, which, again, worked both ways. I mean, it was favorable to the defense, but also favorable to the state, saying, you know, don't draw inferences one way or the other here, but please consider the actions of the police in extracting the statement from Mr. Zayas, but just don't take the police officer's comments as direct assessments of Mr. Zayas's credibility or lack thereof.
You mentioned the curative instruction. What's your response to Mr. Bernstein's position on the efficacy of the curative instruction, considering the timing of it in this particular case?
I'm not mistaken. It came hard on the heels of the entry of the... Now, I could be mistaken on that.
Well, but the point I thought was that there was a motion to redact the statement.
Yes.
And that motion was denied, and the whole statement came in. And then after the whole statement came in, there was this curative instruction.
Yes.
Why is that efficacious or not?
Well, I think it is, and I think that's when it should have come in. Immediately upon the statements, and this is when curative instruction, I think this court in any number of cases said the best time to issue a curative or a limiting instruction.
Yeah, it's not the circumstance where a witness unknown to counsel blurts out something that everyone had agreed shouldn't come in, so there's immediate cautionary instruction.
Yes.
And you don't see there's no distinction here in the way it was handled?
No, the curative instruction was given at the appropriate time. I mean, whether it's the judge knows. Now, the judge, I suppose, could have given some kind of limiting instruction before, since the judge knew the statement was going to come in. But it seems to me that giving it immediately after is equally efficacious. I guess it's simply a matter of timing, and that's generally up to the trial judge's discretion. So the timing, I don't think, is really an issue here. I mean, the curative instruction was given. It was given at the time, immediately after the statement was...
Well, the issue then is whether it should have been redacted at all or not.
Yes, I think it is. And, again, for the reasons I've stated, this was a state's witness and not the defendant. And it did show how Mr. Zayas's cooperation came about, how he made the statement.
Well, but that's the point Mr. Bernstein's making. 3507 talks about the witness's statement. You want to talk about context, and you seem to suggest that the context is helpful to the defense, but maybe the defense isn't asking for any help. Maybe the defense would like just the witness's statement, and so the state would put in the witness's statement, and then the defense could move to the context or not. But I think as a matter of construing the statute, if the history is, as you know, the turncoat witness, where the person said, I wasn't assaulted by the defendant, I fell down the stairs. Then you put in the statement that says, I was assaulted by the defendant. Mm. And that's the 3507 statement, and then it subjected the cross-examination and elaboration. But here, we've moved away from the witness's statement to the police dialogue. And how do we reconcile that with the statute?
Well, first of all, the turncoat witness, 3507 isn't needed for prior inconsistent statements. That's not hearsay under the rules of hearsay. So 3507 is simply eliminates the need to wonder whether a witness's trial testimony is consistent or inconsistent, which is always a problem when one is relying only on the rules of evidence. In Delaware, that is never a problem, since one does not care whether the statement is consistent, inconsistent, or somewhere in between. You can bring it in under both the rules of evidence and 35.
Now, if you have a short amount of time, and we are familiar with a lot of what you're telling us, then my question is, how do we get from 3507 talking about the witness's statement coming in to putting the police dialogue in?
Well, it depends on now. If the witness simply sits down and gives a statement that starts at the beginning and works its way to the end, and there is no police activity pulling the extracting of the statement, certainly. Certainly what the police says is what the police say during the statement, and it seems to me that what the state wanted to bring in here was that Mr. Zayas was not a cooperative witness from the get-go, that it was extracting. It was like pulling teeth getting Mr. Zayas to say these things. Mr. Zayas is not coming on the stand now at trial because of some sweetheart deal. And the state, I think, had valuable reasons for getting in the context in which the statement was made. And to, again, give the jury some kind of redacted version of this statement, which would be practically, which would probably end up being a page instead of 70 or 80 pages, just indicating that Mr. Zayas somehow just gave this wonderful narrative just out of the blue, which incriminates Mr. Guy and Mr. Hassan L.
Should we interpret that?
Would be not true.
Should we interpret that to mean that the police spoke for six pages and the defendant's substantive testimony was only one?
In parts of it, it looks very much like that. I mean, the police are taking, Mr. Zayas is saying the same thing over and over. I didn't know who these guys were. I mean, that could go on for 10 pages. I don't know who these guys were.
So,
and then finally,
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you're agreeing that the reason this statement was put in was not really for the content of the witness's testimony, but in order to get before the jury what the police went through to get these responses. So you're not, if we could break it into pieces, you're not really looking to introduce the witness's statement. You're trying to use 3507 to introduce police testimony.
No, not police testimony. We don't care what the police say.
Well,
But
you don't want this redacted because you want the jury to see what the police did to get his testimony.
Yes.
Which also carries with it what the police had to say and whether they were lies or not, all of this testimony from a police officer, not from a witness.
Well, it's not testimony. It's not being entered in proof to prove the truth of the matter. I mean, it's not what the police say is not testimony.
No,
it's content.
The statute says it comes in as affirmative evidence.
What the witness says.
Exactly, and that's the complication here, because we have a lot of statements that aren't the witness's statements that are coming in under 3507.
Well, these are not, well, my position would be that what the police say are not statements. They don't count as statements. They are for context only. And again, how one would redact this statement, considering the type of statement it is, bits and pieces coming in of what Mr. Zayas says over the course of 80 pages. I don't know. I mean, it would be impossible to do, and would give the basically tell the jury if one put together this one-page narrative that was supposedly said by Mr. Zayas but was never said, that would simply be a lie to the jury. It would be a lie of omission, and I don't think we should lie to the jury unless there's a very good reason to do so, quite frankly.
Well, since we're out of time, you don't give me an opportunity to explore that last statement, which I would love to. But, well, thank you very much, Mr. Holmes.
Thank you.
I wrote down a few bullet points here I'd like to cover. First, the timing of the curative instruction. If you look at the transcript, you'll see that the curative instruction was discussed before the jury ever heard the statement. We knew it was coming in, and there was just nothing else to do. So that was the timing of it. The curative instruction wasn't an afterthought here after the jury had already heard the statement. Mr. Donovan makes a big point about the state really used this statement to show how hard it was for the police to get Mr. Zayas to, quote, tell the truth, unquote. If that was the state's goal, if that's what they wanted to do, all they had to do was put one of these interrogating police officers on the stand to explain, describe, whatever they wanted to say about whether it was difficult or not difficult, whether Zayas was a reluctant witness or a cooperative witness. They certainly could have done that without the embellishment of what occurred here. Well, we know what happened. We know you're lying. That's a completely different animal than putting, if the state wanted to show that Zayas was a reluctant witness, they could have done that innumerable different ways other than presenting this statement to the jury, where they were in effect vouching for Zayas' credibility or lack of credibility, depending on what he said. Mr. Donovan or someone brought up harmless error. Mr. Zayas was obviously, he wasn't just the icing on the cake in this case, he was the cake. He was never charged with any crime, but he was obviously a very active participant, eyewitness. He's as close to this thing as anybody could have gotten. So when the jury is focusing on what happened, the first person they're going to look to as an observer of what happened is Robert Zayas.
But distinguish, if you can, the harm from the 3507 statement that wasn't already done by his testimony in the courtroom.
Well, the harm was the jury is now hearing the police, in effect, vouch for the credibility of Robert Zayas, because if you go through this interrogation, when Zayas says something the police don't agree with, they call him a liar. When they say something he does agree with, they give him a pat on the back. And that's the evil here. If they had just introduced Zayas' statement without the police embellishment, there'd be no objection. That's what was prejudicial.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce.
I see the red lights on.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.